Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.
Welcome back, everyone, to the channel. Tonight's terrifying story is about the main character and his brother, who inherit their father's house after he had passed away. All their life, they were told to avoid and to never attempt to go inside their shed in the backyard. Why? Well, you're soon to find out. Now let's get spooky. If you're new to the channel, subscribe, click on that bell, and smash that thumbs up and tell a friend. Growing up, I remember it all vividly. Any time my friends or I got too close to the shed, my dad would always come out hollering and yelling, telling us to stay away from there, and that it was no place for kids. He told me he had expensive tools and dangerous chemicals stored there. As a child, I didn't question it. It was just one of those things. In my mind, I had been born into a world where the sun rises in the east, breakfast is the first meal of the day, and the shed stays locked. They were all true, self-evident, and simply the way things existed in my young mind. But as I grew older and eventually moved off to college, I began to question the shed more. My father still wouldn't let me look in there. In fact, he kept the sole key on his person at all times. Even when he slept, he would keep the key in his pocket. Then, during my second semester at the nearby state university, I got a call that every son or daughter dreads. I was attending a lecture on anatomy when my phone lit up, ringing silently in the great crowded hall. Looking down, I saw it was my brother's number. I went outside, lighting up a cigarette and answering it. "Hello?" I said. "Gil," my brother answered immediately. "Luke, thank God you answered," he said. "It's Dad. He's been taken to the hospital. He has some sort of medical emergency. Can you meet us there? Maybe in 25 minutes? I said I would, hanging up. I grabbed my stuff in the lecture hall and made my way to my car. 22 minutes later, I pulled into the hospital. It was too late, however. My father had died of a heart attack on the way. He was declared dead on arrival. We ended up inheriting the house. Our mother had died of breast cancer 10 years earlier, so Gil and I were the last two in the Morton bloodline. My brother was a good guy, though somewhat of a waste case, constantly smoking weed and dropping acid. He had a tendency to travel out far across the country without notice, moving around to see nature or go to music festivals. That is, when he had the money. And since he worked as a freelance writer, he was often broke. He really wanted to get the money that Dad had left for us. He wanted the money from the house most of all. He told me repeatedly that it would be enough to tide him over until he got footing in the writing industry. That he just needed to make a name for himself, and then the money would start rolling in. He had his heart set on it. He would write anything that he could make money off of. From horror stories to romances, short stories to novels, even technical manuals or freelance journalism articles. As we walked to the house together for the first time in months, he repeated this mantra to me again. "Just enough to tide me over, Luke." "I think you're probably going to burn through the money that Dad left you," I said. "Why don't you get a real job and write on the side?" He gave me a sideways look. "Did you see Hunter S. Thompson getting a real job while just writing on the side?" he asked. I nodded. "Yeah, he was a journalist." I began as we walked into the house, but we both stopped simultaneously when what we saw on the coffee table. It was all of Dad's possessions he had when he died. They were placed neatly in a line, his wallet, his phone, his car and house key, some cash, and last of all, a little shed key on a thin leather chain. "What do you think is really in that shed?" I asked. Gil looked at me, pale and wide-eyed in the dark living room. I don't know if I want to find out," Gil said, whispering as if he was in a church or a funeral home. I put my hand on his shoulder and shook him gently. "Of course we need to find out," I said. "You and I own this property now. We should go look right now." He breathed in sharply. "No, no, don't be an idiot," Gil whispered. "It's dark now. In the morning we could go together. In the morning. You have waited 20 years to find out. I think you could wait a few more hours." But there was something pleading in his voice, something scared and childlike. It reminded me of when I was scared as a little boy at bedtime, telling my dad there were monsters in the closet, and he would go to open up the door, and I'd tell him to stop, that they're gonna hurt him if he opens the door. But he would open the door, and there would be no monsters in there. Surely, it was the same here. Gil would see, and for that matter, so would I. There was no monsters in there. All this happened from yesterday to this morning. We ended up leaving that place together a few hours ago, bloodied and bruised and injured after being trapped inside all night. The day before it started, Gil stayed up late downstairs, watching TV and smoking a joint. He made himself a nightcap from my father's liquor cabinet, pouring some Jack Daniels and ice in a cup with some Coke and sipping it slowly. I stayed with him for a while talking. We talked about the good times we had with Dad, about going hiking with him at the Green Mountains, or traveling to New York City with him to see the museums. I thought about how much I really missed him, and a knot formed in my throat. I quickly blinked my eyes to try to get the tears to go away. Eventually, I went to sleep in the guest bedroom. Gil stayed downstairs, sleeping on the couch in front of the TV. I heard the faint hum of it from upstairs, the canned laughter of whatever comedy he was watching, the acerbic tone of the lead characters as they delivered one witty joke after another. I fell asleep to it, the voices bleeding into my sarcastic, hissing whisper in my ear. And then I was floating, bodiless, looking down on a dark cornfield with ravens staring at me. The voice was bodiless too, sounding like it came from right behind me. But when I turned, nothing was there. "In the halls of our fathers, everyone is dead," it whispered mockingly. "You'll be dead soon, too, if you get curious. Some doors are locked for a reason. Some doors should stay locked." I woke up suddenly. Something was wrong. I heard Gil yelling. I fumbled around in the dark for the lamp, groggily checking the time, 4:17 a.m. Flinging the comforters off, I ran downstairs. Gil was sleeping on the couch, still as a corpse and quiet as one too. I looked around confused. Where was the screaming coming from? I followed the noise out back. I looked at the shed, and my blood ran cold as I heard another long cry come from inside. I walked across the dirt yard in my slippers, not wanting to get any closer, but walking towards nonetheless. Part of me wondered if I was still dreaming, but the chill air against my sweaty face felt real enough. The screaming from the shed was not in words. It was a long, drawn-out, painful shriek. It was the shriek of a mother who had lost her only child in a war zone, or the yell of someone doused with gasoline and burned alive, but amplified into an ear-splitting cacophony. I had the key in my pocket. I reached for it with shaking hands, pulling it out, slowly approaching the shed. Then someone grabbed my shoulder. I jumped, whirling around in clenched fists, ready to fight. Then I saw it was Gil. "You nearly gave me a heart attack," I said through clenched teeth. "What the hell is wrong with you?" He put his finger to his lips, the universal signal for silence. Then he leaned closer to my ear and whispered, "If you open that shed now, we will both die," he said quietly and calmly, as if he just stated the weather for tomorrow. "Put the key away and go back to bed. You never want to open it in the dark. Never." "What do you know about it?" I whispered back, shooting glances over my shoulder at the shed. The screaming still came, though slower now, maybe one heart-rending shriek every minute or so. Part of me was glad there was no neighbors for half a mile in each direction, and that made me want to laugh. There was probably a horrific animal in there that would rip me apart if it had the chance, and I was thinking about noise complaints. "Tomorrow," Gil repeated, gently taking my arm and leading me back into the house. I sat next to him in the living room, pouring myself a gin and tonic, sipping it slowly as the screams from behind the house mixed with the canned laughter on the TV show, wondering what kind of man my father really was. I awoke on the couch, an empty glass falling out of my hand onto the cushion. Light streamed in through the windows. Gil was nowhere to be found. I looked back and forth, then heard the sizzling of food from the kitchen. Stumbling in, I saw he had prepared a massive breakfast of bacon, sausages, corned beef hash, eggs benedict with hollandaise sauce, Texas toast, orange juice, and coffee. He was smoking a joint with the windows opened, occasionally sending a grim look out the back of the house towards the shed. I sat down, pouring myself some coffee, and grabbed milk and sugar to mix it. "Who is all this food for?" I asked. He kept staring out the window. "Hey!" He turned suddenly, his face looking pale and drawn. "What?" I said, "Who is all this food for?" I repeated. He looked around, smiling. "Just for us. Why not? I figured you will need the energy today, and so will I," he said cryptically. He sat down across from me, pouring himself coffee and orange juice and grabbing a plateful of meat, toast, and eggs. I did the same, giving him occasional glances. "What did Dad tell you?" I asked, pouring maple syrup on my sausages and bacon, and chugging an entire cup of coffee in one long swallow. It burned my throat, but the rising heat and caffeine made me feel instantly better and more awake. Gil sighed heavily. "Not much, to tell you the truth," he said. "He was really drunk one time when you were away at college a couple of months ago. He was drinking more and more before he died, like something was weighing on him, something he wanted to forget. Well, anyway, I was sitting there with him, watching those documentaries he used to love with him. And during a commercial, he just started talking about the shed. Now, boy," he said to me, "I know you probably have a few questions for me. I probably should have told you and your brother about it a long time ago, but it is something I don't like to talk about. Out of sight, out of mind, I guess. I think talking about it tends to wake it up." "Wake up what?" I said. Dad was quiet for a long time, just staring at me. Then he leaned close to me and whispered something strange. "The stairs," he said. "They're not normal, son. Sometimes they go down below the shed to a... well, I guess it's just an empty subfloor. Just a plain swept dirt basement below the shed. But I never built any such subfloor, and it wasn't there when I bought the house. And it wasn't on the plans either. If that was it, then who would care? A free storage place, people would be happy, right?" I nodded, grinning back at Dad. He seemed to have a glimmer of his old self for a second, happy and free. But then his face darkened again. "But lots of times, boy, those stairs do not lead to a subfloor. One time they led down to a white room covered in blood, with bright fluorescent lights flickering all over the walls and ceiling. And there was a little girl down there, dancing amongst all the blood. Jumping and twirling in her little blue dress, little ballerina slippers on her feet, and all the skin on her face peeled off. She was just a bloody, grinning skull. And then she saw me on the spiral steps in the corner. She stopped dancing and just stared. The lights began to turn off. Everything went dark, and I ran, my boy. I ran faster than I have ever ran in my life. I felt the little hands grabbing at me as I made my way up the last stair and slammed the shed door behind me. I locked it as something fought to get out, something that felt far stronger than any child. And that was just one time. It's worse at night. That's when the real dangerous ones come out. I don't know how the stairs work, son, and I don't think I ever really want to. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll never have to deal with them. Maybe I'll find a way to destroy them before I die. And maybe... Gil stopped speaking, deep in thought and remembrance. I took another sip of juice and ate some bacon before responding. "So you're telling me Dad went batshit crazy before he died?" I asked. Gil shook his head quickly. "He wasn't crazy, Luke," he said simply. "At least, I don't think he was. If he was, the stairs probably made him that way. Do you really think that you were just hearing a fox or something caught in a shed last night? Those screams sounded human. We both know that was something unnatural. But I wouldn't worry if I were you. If you need proof, we'll have plenty after today, assuming you still want to go into the shed." And after we finished eating, with no fanfare or delay, we did. I grabbed the key, and Gil and I went outside by the shed, scared but not showing it, ready to finally see for ourselves the mystery that had haunted our family for decades. We walked through the hard-packed dirt yard, looking down the grassy field behind the house to the rolling hills that stretched as far as the eye could see. They began to grow blue, pale, and fuzzy near the horizon. It was a beautiful place to live, and hard to imagine something so evil might be right in the middle of it. The shed loomed up ahead of us, boards tightly hammered together and freshly painted a dark red color. The shingles on the small roof all looked relatively new, and the door was expensive and sturdy. I stood in front of the door, listening for the sounds of any movement, but there was nothing. I fumbled in my pocket for the key, pulling it out, looking at Gil, who stood close by my side. Then I shoved it in the lock and opened the door. The shed was dark, as if a curtain of shadow fell across the open door. I stuck my head in, feeling around for the side for a light switch. And that was when something grabbed my hand. I screamed, ready to pull my hand out and run. And then I felt the light switch on the wall. I flicked it on quickly. There was no one there. Shaking, I turned to Gil. "Something grabbed me," I whispered. He nodded unsurprised. Then we walked into the shed together. The walls inside were all covered with plates of sheet metal. Every square inch of the shed was reinforced with steel, including the roof, which had a flat pane of metal going straight across the shed, welded to the floor that covered the walls. Only the floor was unprotected. It was just a plain dirt floor with a hole in the center. Looking closer at the protective structure of the shed, I saw deep claw and gouge marks raking the metal surface, even though on the bottom of the ceiling 8 feet above the door. Something had clearly been in here and wanted very badly to get out. I inched closer to the hole in the floor, which took up most of the floor of the shed. It was at least 10 feet wide. Looking down, I saw spiraling steps, descending into a clockwise fashion as far down as the light extended. I found a small rock on the ground outside, came back in, and dropped it down the center of the stairway. I listened for it to hit the bottom, counting the seconds on my watch. After about 30 seconds, I realized it wasn't going to. Maybe it was too far down the here where the stone connected. I looked over at Gil. He was standing as near to the door as he could get, looking like he would rather be anywhere else in the world. I gave him high marks for courage, though. There was something wrong in here, and I could feel it. Outside, it was warm, and a fresh breeze blew the smell of flowers and pines through the yard. But in here, it was cold and oppressive. A freezing chill seemed to come up the hole in the floor, spiraling up with the stairs and running over my body, sending a feeling like ice running up and down my back. "Do you want to go first, or should I?" I said, gesturing to the hole. Gil stared at me as if I had gone mad, his eyes widening. "Why the F should either of us go down?" Raising his hands and using them to gesticulate widely, as he often did when he was upset. I shrugged. "This is our property now," I said. "We need to at least know what's on it, don't you think?" But there was another reason, too. It was sheer curiosity and a desire to prove to myself that there was nothing supernatural going on here. No monster in the closet, just the overactive imagination of an old man. Gil sighed. "Fine," he said. "I'll go. Go grab 2 flashlights and Dad's gun. Maybe some extra batteries. Some extra magazines, too. Better be safe than sorry, after all." We both went inside the house together, leaving the shed door wide open, and that was when, I believe, something got out. And then the killings in town began. We descended the stairs slowly. They were stone slick in some places. There was no guardrail or any protective barrier, which made my heart beat a little faster. I liked something to hold on to. If I took a tumble on these stairs, I might be falling forever. We heard strange sounds from below periodically, but when we shone our lights down there, we couldn't see anything. Echoes rose around us. Sounds at one point like kids playing a game of hide-and-seek, and another like howling of a wolf. Strange squeaks and clicks would also arise intermittently from the shaft below us, and then stop as quickly as they had started. The noises got louder as we descended dozens of stories, then hundreds. It seemed like the stairs would just keep going on forever, until we hit the mantle of the earth and got burned up. Then a door appeared, painted a chipped blue with a fading daisy on the center of it. I looked at Gil, then swung it open. Beyond it, a hallway with fluorescent lights extended as far as the eye could see. Countless rooms went off to the left and right. The lights flickered on and off, sending portions of the hallway into darkness. The floor was falling apart in many places, with strange molds and fungi growing out of the wood. White and black molds battled for space, forming huge colonies that were bigger than my shoe. I walked forward, putting my weight gingerly on the floorboard. It creaked slightly and felt wet under my shoe, yet it held my weight. "Come on," I said to Gil, who followed closely behind. As soon as we had walked a few steps down the hall, the door slammed shut by itself behind us. I jumped and turned, pulled out my gun reflexively. Gil put a hand on my shoulder, pushing the gun back down. "It's okay," he said. I was breathing hard, my heart hammering in my chest. Maybe that was why I didn't hear the counting at first. But as we walked down the decaying hallway, the lights turned on and off above us with every step. I realized that someone was counting, and it had been going on for quite a while. It sounded like the voice of a little girl.
40, 39, 38, she said, counting off the seconds.
I heard giggling from the rooms around us, but I couldn't see anyone. We kept walking forward, But that counting was getting on my nerves, not least because I couldn't for the life of me tell where it was coming from. We checked the rooms to the left and the right. There were broken tables, old office equipment, and chairs in nearly all of them. Some of them had fish tanks, but instead of fish, they had plumes of multicolored molds growing over the top of them, or in one case, a dead and dried out turtle.
One, ready or not,
here I come.
The girl's voice screamed gleefully. And that was when all the lights went out at once. We quickly fumbled for our flashlights, turning them on at the same time. I had the gun in one hand crisscrossed with the flashlight in the other, a trick that I had seen used in cop shows. Gil had a 10-inch Bowie knife in one hand, which he had just removed from a massive scabbard he had around his leg. In his other hand, he held the flashlight, which he frantically shone back and forth, up and down. "Jeez, calm down with that thing," I said. "You're gonna make me dizzy."
"Something's coming," Gil whispered, a note of dread in his voice. "Don't you hear it?"
I stopped, listening hard. Indeed, I heard footsteps nearing, small, suppressed giggles, the swishing of a dress. My flashlight illuminated a pale face, a little boy sneaking a peek out the nearest room. He was filthy, covered in black soot, with torn clothing, and what looked like blood caked into his hair. He looked up at us quickly, then withdrew into the room. For the first time, I felt genuinely scared. Now we could be certain we were being watched.
"Hey!"
I whispered, running into the room after him. Gil followed close behind me. The footsteps seemed to be right next to us now, but I looked around, not seeing anyone. Then a blur of movement passed by as the little girl ran over to the little boy, where he was curled up in the corner of a broken folding table, crying and shaking with terror.
"Found you," she said.
I shone my light directly at her back, seeing a pale blue dress, but I couldn't see her face.
"Get away from that kid," I yelled.
She ignored me, bending down quickly, and before I knew what had happened, she had ripped the boy's throat out with her teeth. She turned to look at us, and I saw that her face had been cut off, and now was a grinning skull remaining. It was covered in a thin sheen of blood, and two tiny white pinpoints of light seemed to glow inside the empty sockets of her eyes, with her teeth full of flesh and gristle and fleshy rivulets of blood running down her skeletal mouth. She continued to cry.
"Found you, found you, found you!"
Without hesitation, I shot her in the shoulder. She fell back a half step, turning to look at me with a skeletal grin, then spun around and continued eating the little boy. He was still alive, choking on his own blood, his huge eyes moving over to me as he died, as if accusing me of being the cause of all of this. The sound of his last gurgling breaths were the only sounds now. I shot her again, but she wouldn't go down. A blossom of blood began to spread outwards on her back where I had shot her, but she showed no pain. Gil grabbed my shoulder tightly.
"We need to get out of here,"
he said through gritted teeth. I nodded. We ran back to the door we had come in through, but it was locked tight. The lights were still off. I told Gil to take a step back, then tried shooting at the lock. The bullet ricocheted crazily as if I had shot a reinforced army tank rather than a plain wooden doorway. Next, we tried kicking it open, but it was as if it was fused to the wall. I turned to look at him, and the truth passed between us in a glimpse. To get out, we would have to go farther in, where there were likely even worse things waiting for us. Part 2. The darkness around us was oppressive, cloying and total.
Anywhere we weren't pointing our flashlights would turn into a solid wall of black, impenetrable shadows. But we could hear something. As we walked further down the hallway, we heard soft footsteps and giggling. Sometimes, it sounded like it came from directly behind us. At other times, it would come from the rooms all around us, the endless rooms that split off the hallway on both sides. We found some strange things in those rooms as we walked slowly, the gun raised in my hand and the Bowie knife raised in my brother's. There were corpses in some of the rooms. Many had partially mummified in the dry, chilly air down here. Others were clearly fresher. A woman was hanging from the rafters with a note pinned to her chest. I looked back at Gil when we reached this part of the hall. We had stayed out of the rooms since the incident with the little boy. But some deep innate curiosity needed to know what was on this note. Gil nodded at me, and we walked forward side by side, scanning every corner of the room and looking behind smashed out fish tanks and torn sofas covered in black mold for any signs that we weren't alone in here. Once we were both satisfied, we returned to the young woman hanging in the center of the room. She had somehow climbed up to the ceiling, opened a panel, and found a sturdy enough beam or rafter to tie the rope to. Yet there was no ladder or anything remotely tall enough to reach the ceiling nearby. It was somewhat of a mystery. I explained this to Gil, who looked somewhat confused and alarmed. He clearly hadn't realized it until I pointed it out to him. I turned back to the woman's corpse, picking off the note, which had been stuck into the front of her blouse with a huge wooden splinter. Gil kept a lookout while I read, shining his light back and forth in a circle across the room, holding his ridiculously huge knife in the other hand like some sort of medieval swordsman. I saw with increasing horror that this note appeared to have been written in the woman's own blood. Looking at her body, I saw a deep slash on her left arm, one that had clotted for days. I looked down at the desperate message this dying woman had left for us. To anyone who finds this, my name is Michelle Mansfield. I came in here by accident through the sewers underneath the town of Kaplan. My two friends and I were exploring, and we had gotten separated after a girl in our group twisted her ankle. I went forward alone to find help while my other friend stayed behind with the injured girl. After perhaps a day of being lost, my flashlight started to die, and I thought I was going to die with it. And then I saw a fluorescent light up ahead. They were flickering and looked like they might sputter out at any moment, but it was the only hope I had. I followed the lights and found myself in this hallway. When I tried to turn around and go back, the entrance to the sewers had disappeared. It was just a hallway that seemed to extend forever, the one that has haunted me for weeks now. Please, if you find this note, tell my parents what happened to me. Take my golden locket and return it to my mother and father as proof. I hope you have better luck getting out of here than I did. Goodbye, and may God forgive me for what I'm about to do. Michelle. I looked up at Gil with one eyebrow raised. I saw he had been reading the note over my shoulder rather than keeping a lookout. I sighed, deciding not to say anything. "We can't take the locket," I said. Gil shook his head. "We have to take the locket," he said. "They're gonna think we had something to do with this girl's death if we just show up randomly with a piece of her jewelry. Actually, I think I remember when this girl and her friends went missing. It was on the news. Her parents were pleading for anyone with information to come forward. I think the cops were acting on the suspicion that it was a murder or a kidnapping or something. But they probably just went exploring without telling anyone and never came back. We'll wipe it down and send it anonymously through the mail with a note explaining what happened," he said. I sighed, giving up. He was right. It was the right thing to do. But I'm not sure many innocent men have gone to prison over trying to do the right thing. I pointed to the note. "This doesn't help us at all," I said. He shrugged. Maybe it does, and maybe it doesn't. It doesn't really help us formulate a plan, but it does give us information. For example, now we know that this place probably connects to a lot more places than the shed. We might be able to get out through dozens or hundreds of exits. If it connects to a random sewer over in Kaplan, then it could connect to places all over the country. True, I said. But what if it connects to some alien world? Or to a black hole? What if it connects to some point in the void between galaxies, and we get sucked out to our deaths? He simply shrugged again, seeming apathetic to these possibilities. Well, in that case, he said smugly, a half-smile forming on his lips, our deaths would probably be a lot quicker than they would be at the hands of these creatures down here. Then he started laughing. It sounded eerie in this dark, forlorn place, where everything smelled like yeast, and the floors were all wet substrates growing strange jungles of alien molds. He reached forward and took the golden locket off of the woman's neck, placing it carefully into his pocket. We started walking out of the room together. Also, I said, the note seems to imply that the entrances are temporary. She couldn't find her way back out after she had gotten in here. What if they're all like that? What if they're all like, I don't know, lobster traps or Venus flytraps or something? They draw people in, and then once they're inside... I stopped speaking as soon as I realized I heard someone following us. I heard running footsteps. A high-pitched giggling started, then was cut off. We both stood there in the darkness, our flashlights pointing forward. Then the voice of that demonic little girl started up, high-pitched and somewhat inhuman-sounding. Her words all had a strange hoarseness to them, an uncanny valley sound, as if she was only imitating human emotions and human speech.
Adam's it, but he won't play,
she said sulkily, her voice bouncing off the walls, the rapid beat of footsteps approaching nearer and nearer.
He said his throat hurts, so I guess I'm it. You better run.
God damn it, Gil said, swiping his giant knife around from side to side, as if he was going to bat a mosquito with it. His light flashed and wavered as he tried to keep a watch on all sides, but I knew she was coming from behind us. I could feel it. I kept my light shining down there, the gun raised, trying to emanate a calm I didn't feel. Then I saw a flash of blue, zigzagging crazily past a chair leg, and the snapped remains of a folded table, tiny legs pumping at a superhuman speed. She looked like little more than an approaching blur.
Listen to me very carefully, I said, trying to keep my gun pointed on her. We need to cut off her head.
What? Gil said. Why?
Last time, bullets didn't work on... I began. But then she was on us, no more than a few feet away, jumping over the discarded junk that intermittently appeared on the sides of the hallway. And then I felt myself knocked over by a tremendous force that shook the air right out of my lungs. I still had my hands crossed out in front of me, one holding the gun and the other on the flashlight. The skeletal face of the creature was mere inches away from my own, biting and gnawing madly. I could see small muscles in the back of her mouth working furiously. She was pushing down on my arms with all of her strength, which was far more than such a small body seemed to suggest. The gun was pressed closely to the front of her chest. I was about to pull the trigger when I felt the weight start to lift off me. I saw Gil behind her, wrapping his arm around her neck and pulling her back. She still gnawed and bit in a mad frenzy, small droplets of blood and saliva dripping off her mouth and into my face. She kicked her body back and forth like an enraged snake, freeing her neck from Gil's grasp. He went to grab her, and her skeletal face opened up wide, the jaw hanging halfway down her neck. With the speed of a cat snatching a mouse, she leapt forward, snatching her jaw around some of the fingers on Gil's left hand. I saw his index and middle finger disappear into her mouth, and he began to scream in agony.
I was scrambling back to my feet by this point. I ran at the girl, using all my body weight to push her. She went tumbling to the floor, her mouth flying open as she landed hard on the wood. Two mutilated fingers flew out, rolling across the floor and disappearing into a dome of black mold. I was sweating heavily now, droplets of sweat rolling down my forehead and stinging my eyes. I tried wiping them away, thinking of what to do. My mind screamed at me to shoot, to empty my entire magazine into this little monster, but I knew in my heart that it would just be wasting bullets. Deep down, I knew what I had told Gil earlier was true. We had to cut off her head. Just like in the old myths of vampires or demons, I had a deep instinctual feeling that fire or decapitation would be the only way to deal with her, and as for fire, we had no flamethrowers. "Gil," I said, "get ready!" He was holding his spurting hand tightly against his chest, still grasping the Bowie knife in his right. His face was alarmingly pale and white, and I wondered if he might not just pass out right here and doom both of us. But he hadn't dropped the knife, even while fighting that wiggling monster, even while getting his fingers bitten off. He is stronger than he looks, I reassured myself. A sense of calm and clarity overcame me then, and I saw what I needed to do. The demonic girl was getting up, growling and spitting and laughing. I ran over and stomped on her back, putting my full weight onto her body and driving her back down. Then I took the pistol and shot her through the back of the kneecaps, one bullet for each. She wailed as dark red blood poured out of her small legs, turning her head almost all the way back to try and bite me. Her hands were changing. The small fingers were lengthening and darkening into sharp black claws, and I knew our time was running out.
"Now!" I yelled, and Gil ran forward, using his right hand to swing the Bowie knife. I watched it fall in a descending arc, as if in slow motion, watched it approach the splitting skeletal face that looked at us with black eyes and unfathomable hatred. It went clean through, and was so sharp that for a split second, the head stayed there, the face blank, looking like it was still attached to the body. Then it tumbled forward. Dark blood spurted out of the neck and staining the white and gold molds underneath with its crimson hue. Gil fell back against the wall, breathing fast. He dropped the Bowie knife on the floor. I saw his flashlight still on, had rolled against an ancient wheelchair that was probably new back in the 1960s. I stopped and grabbed it, shoving it into my pants belt so it would give me more light to work with. Gil was still holding his hand tight to his chest. Slowly, I put my hands forward and grasped his injured hand by the wrist. He inhaled deeply, gritting his teeth and closing his eyes. "We're gonna need the rapid in something," I said. He nodded. I took off my shirt and started ripping long slices from the bottom, then wrapping them around his hand tightly in the attempt to slow the bleeding. When I got to the fingers, he flinched and seemed to waver on his feet. He reached a hand out in case he was about to fall over, but he managed to steady himself. "All done," I told him as I put my shirt back on, which was missing the bottom third portion, now looking rather absurd, almost as if I was wearing a woman's crop top. "It feels like my hand's on fire," Gil said in a hoarse whisper. "We're gonna need water, too." I was feeling the start of dehydration pangs myself. "That girl, Michela... her note said she was stuck in here for weeks. That must mean there's water, assuming her counting was correct, seeing as there's no sun or sky to go by. If there was no water, she would have died after a few days, especially being on the move," I said. I was hoping that we would find food as well, but it wasn't really life or death. I knew that we could potentially go weeks without food and still live, even though it would feel extremely unpleasant and weakened us physically. I sighed, shining my flashlight at Gil. "Ready to keep going?" I asked, and then the lights started turning back on. Most of them were still either out or flickering on and off rapidly, but enough of them were lit to see down the hall. "Oh, thank God," Gil said,
At least now we're not walking through this junkyard in the frickin' dark. Up ahead, I saw something new as well. It looked like the hallway forked off. I pointed at it, and Gil's eyes widened. Finally, after walking for endless miles, this place does something. As we neared it, I saw there was even a sign. One pointed left, reading, "To Veridin." The other pointed right, reading, "To Rusty Township." "Huh," I said. "I've never heard of either of those places. They're definitely not in the country." Gil's dark brown eyes looked past me into the room behind us, and they widened. I reached for the pistol, turning quickly, but I found nothing but a mostly empty, half-lit room. Against the corner was a vending machine and a soda machine. "Oh, thank God," I said, running forward, reaching in my pocket for some money. Then I remembered I had left my wallet at home. After all, I thought we were just going into the shed. Gil strode right past me.
"Don't be an idiot," he said, taking the butt of his Bowie knife and smashing the glass of the vending machine. "You don't need money. Who's going to call the cops, the walking undead and demons here?" He pulled out brands I had never heard of. "Over Holster's beef jerky, chocolate bars with caramel and peanuts called Eisenhearts, Took's saltwater taffy and Riza's fruit snacks?" The other vending machine was no less alien, as I smashed it with the butt of my gun and found Springy's lemon-lime soda, Conabrand cola, and St. Christoph's ginger ale, among others. Not one of the brands was recognizable from our world. We tore into the food with ravenous hunger, chugging bottle after bottle of soda. It all tasted similar enough to what we expected, though some of it was rather strange. The ginger ale, for example, had small silver shavings on the bottom of each bottle, their trademark gimmick, and Gil swallowed them and nearly ended up choking. I smacked his back hard, laughing. "I don't think you're supposed to drink those," I said sarcastically. We were filling up our pockets when the drumming started from down the hall. It was so sudden and loud in the otherwise perfect silence that I jumped nearly a foot, spinning around and taking out the gun. It was becoming second nature to me by this point, and so much adrenaline was constantly pumping through my body that I was as jumpy as a cat. The drumming grew louder and fast. It reminded me of the drums some ancient Aztecs must have used when cutting out the hearts of their prisoners of war. It had a deep, primal beat to it that would be useful for stirring people up during acts of savagery and violence. It was coming from the direction labeled Rusty Township. I could barely hear myself think over the intensity of the drum beats. I tried the motion to Gil that I would go first since I had the gun, that he should just stay behind me. But he looked like he was just smiling and nodding, and likely had not understood a bit of what I was trying to communicate. Sign, I started forward down the corridor. I peeked my head around the next corner, where a doorway opened up into a huge gymnasium. The ceiling towered over me. I saw dirty, disheveled people standing in a semicircle around a metal coffin that was stood up at one end against the back wall. Blood was pouring out the bottom, flowing a river of clotted gore that stretched across the gymnasium and curved off to the right corner. The people surrounding the metal coffin were laughing, clapping their hands and cheering, stomping their feet in time with the beats. I saw scurvy blossoms and festering sores across their faces and exposed skin. And for the first time since we had gotten lost down here, there were windows around the edge of this massive chamber, windows showing the outside world. I ran over looking out. I saw a city on fire, the buildings burning and sending up thick black plumes of smoke. It reminded me of when Berlin at the end of World War II must have looked like. Fronts of houses had collapsed inwards. The streets were cracked and filled with debris, and I saw bodies hanging from lampposts up and down the street. Many of them were so old that the ropes were starting to fray.
Some of the bodies had started to mummify, with thin, papery skin, clinging tightly to desiccated muscles and hanging jaws. Around the corners of houses and alleyways, I caught glimpses of strange shapes, crouching half-animal, half-human beings who carried sledgehammers and long knives, robed figures who seemed to float over the devastated and cracked ground, and children with red skin who I saw crawling up walls on all fours like geckos. The drums stopped as suddenly as they had started. My ears were still ringing. I turned back to the semicircle of sickly, dirty people. They had stopped their clapping and dancing and cheering, and now just stood like statues, staring at Gil and me with flat, dead eyes.
"You shouldn't stare into the township," a thin woman with filthy black hair said. A strange accent crept onto her words, one that I had never heard before. "Strange things live in there, and they come out when the drums stop." She stepped forward, whispering, "We keep them away by giving a sacrifice every time the drumbeats come. The blood satisfies the ones in the city and the others in the halls. We will have our turn in this coffin, sure enough."
Another member of the group stepping forward and opened the metal coffin. I saw long, thin spikes sliding out of the body, and then a pale form fell out, landing on the dirt floor with a wet smacking sound. The smell of coppery blood in the air was now overwhelming. Gil and I both gasping in unison as we saw the form on the floor was a person, a young woman in fact, almost totally drained of blood. Dozens of puncture marks were sliced into her face, neck and stomach, legs and arms. An expression of pain and horror was frozen onto her dead face, her wide eyes staring straight, looking at the ceiling.
"You killed her!"
Gil said aghast, still clutching his mutilated hand close to his body in an unconscious gesture of his anxiety and fear.
"Why? Why would you put someone from your own group in an Iron Maiden?"
"Iron Maiden?"
the woman with the black hair in front responded.
"Hey, that's as good a name for it as any. We call her the Steel Mistress in my world, in my time, and the Steel Mistress sees a lot of use."
She gestured out the window, her face emotionless.
"You see, my world, after all, it is a place that always reeks of death, and more often than not, reeks of fire, too."
"What part of the United States is this?" Gil asked, gesturing out the window. The woman frowned.
"I do not know these United States," she said, shrugging.
"What country are you from?" he asked.
"Why, Victorate, of course. But Victorate only has three states. Rusty Township was the capital, until it was attacked by the Black Hand Allegiance soldiers. We're all refugees from Rusty here," she said sadly.
"This isn't getting us anywhere," I said to Gil under my breath. He nodded sign. "Can you tell us the way to get back to the stone steps? Big circular stone steps that go around and around." Gil asked the woman in one last attempt to get a sensical answer out of her. She nodded her grimy face.
"Ah, in the center of the undergraves," she said, pointing past the Iron Maiden and the deadly body on the ground.
I realized that there was a sign up on the ceiling in front of the next corridor, one pointing left and saying, "To Rusty Township Center," and one pointing right and saying, "To the undergraves." The sign was so covered in dust and specks of black mold that it was no wonder I hadn't seen it. "Do you have any maps of this place?" I asked the dirty woman and her friends. They all shook their heads.
"There are no maps in the undergraves, but the stairs would be in the center. You just take the right here and follow the path straight. Ignore all forks on the right or left. Just keep following it straight."
We were walking away fast now, trying to leave these lunatics behind.
"But you'd be mad to go there now that the drums have stopped."
Her voice was fading rapidly as Gil and I ran forward.
"Those people are frickin' nuts," Gil said. "Killing each other just because they think the blood keeps away demons?"
"Brother," I said through heavy breaths,
If you and I lived down here for a few months, we would just be as crazy as those people. As we jogged into the undergraves, I realized the walls were turning into something organic and pulsating, like being in some huge intestine. Massive forks to the left and right appeared every few hundred feet. From them, dark shapes appeared, stepping forward. They moved shakily, blurring as they stepped to the right or left randomly, their mouths opening wide and seeming to be filled with blackness. Their eyes looked like pure black sockets, and the rest of their body was no more than a shaky silhouette of shadows. When the first few stepped forward, I didn't know what to do. I gingerly raised the gun, deciding better safe than sorry. They were coming at me fast, jerking randomly, their skin seeming to writhe and sliver as I stared at them. As they got within 10 feet of me, a deep burning heat started to fill my body, as if I was standing in front of an oven. I started shooting one bullet for each of their center mass, and they dissipated into smoke. I watched the black stuff curl back into the red pulsating room they had just come out of, the sense of heat dissipating instantly, but my skin still felt warm and strange. We were running through the undergraves now, miles of slick gore covering the floors, strange tissues growing across the rooms, and tumor-like sacs covering the fluorescent lights, which even here flickered endlessly across the ceilings. In many of the rooms, I saw people strung upside down from the ceiling, their ribs sliced open. Strange, hunched figures slicing the meat into strips, preparing it and drying it. One of them looked at me with its pig-like face, its bovine legs walking across the sticky floor, slowly and uncertainly at first, and then running for me. I was running low on ammunition at this point. Gil came from behind and disemboweled the creature as it raised its butcher knife. It had been so focused on me that it hadn't noticed him jogging up with his blood-stained Bowie knife in one hand. "I can't run much longer," Gil said, panting. I nodded warily. Neither could I. "My hand is still on fire, too. I really should have gotten medical attention like 12 hours ago." Part of me wondered if the stairs were even here, or if we had been lied to, sent into the worst part of this strange hall to become sacrifices to these abominations. We had, after all, put our lives in the hands of a band of lunatics. But at this point, we had nowhere else to go but forwards. Part 3. The undergraves were as close to literal hell as I could imagine. In fact, we only survived because of a twist of fate and a sad, lonely mutant. There were creatures everywhere, and most of them were horrible things to behold. More of the strange pigmen with long knives had come out of the surrounding rooms. They always had human bodies hung up and butchered, drying meat stretched out on hooks all around the room. Hell, if Gil and I had no problem with cannibalism, we would eat for years in this place. I had shot at least a dozen of the pigmen, trying to conserve my ammo by using only a single headshot when possible, and Gil had decapitated probably a dozen more. Some of them we just ran away from, especially if they were in large groups. But it felt like we were going further into the fire rather than escaping from it. There were windows now, endless windows along the sides of the rooms, and they showed a world in flames. I saw people with missing limbs huddled around barrel fires in bombed-out cities, husks of tanks scattered across the street, and bodies hanging from the lampposts. I began to see where the meat to feed all these creatures was coming from. Gil and I found a room with a pyramid of clothing, shoes, and glasses that stretched to the top of the room. "Brother," Gil said, "this place makes me sick." I sighed, sitting down on a pile of clothing and opening up some beef jerky and a candy bar. I checked my ammo supplies and realized I was down to my last magazine. "I can't wait to get out of this frickin' place," I said. the smell of so many dead bodies must have seeped into my clothing by now. Then I heard a soft rustling from behind me. I turned my body, pulling up the gun and pointing it. A strange man stood there with his hands up. He reminded me of pictures I had seen of the Elephant Man. Tumors and scarred, round growths stuck out all over his head. His forehead sloped radically to the left, and one of his eyes was slanted, the folds of skin around it hanging loosely above and beneath it. He had on an old military uniform, one I assumed he scrounged from some dead body. My finger tightened on the trigger for a moment, then I realized he had no visible weapons.
"Please," he said. "Can I get a chocolate bar?"
I laughed, breaking the tension and handing him an Eisenhart. It was apparently a brand he knew and loved, for he ripped it open and ate it, smiling and bowing. I gave him a soda, too. His face brightened like a child's.
"Thank you, thank you. Nice men, very nice."
"What is your name, friend?" Gil said slowly, still holding his Bowie knife tightly. I still had my finger on the trigger as well, but I had a feeling we wouldn't be needing weapons for this guy.
"Frankie," he said. His smile was so wide now that it showed all three of his remaining teeth. "I'm a friend?"
"Sure," I said. "Why not?" "Frankie, my name is Luke and this is Gil. We're good guys. We're not from here. In fact, we are trying to get out. Do you know how to get out of here?" Frankie paused for a long moment, as if that many sentences at once had overloaded his brain's processing power. His face took on a slack, vacant look. Then he brightened and nodded.
"You could go to Rusty Township right out there,"
he said excitedly, pointing out the window to where the woman's body was being picked apart by angry, squawking birds. I shook my head, smiling. "While that seems like a really nice place," I said, "I'm actually looking for another where we came down on a circular stone stairs. Some real nice people told us that the stairs could be found over here in the undergraves, if you follow the strange hallway covered in muscle and skin straight. Those real nice people had also been cheering and clapping as they shoved one another in an Iron Maiden and let the blood soak into the floors," I remembered. Frankie laughed, a genuine happy sound that felt strange in this place.
"No, friend," he said, wiping a tear from his eye. "If you go straight into the undergraves, you come up to the pit of the skull. There's thousands of angry demons in there. They'll eat you."
He continued laughing.
"I think your other friends played a joke on you."
I swore, my face darkening. Gil looked like he was about to be sick. "Never trust a woman with scurvy blossoms on her face," Gil muttered. "I should have known." "So we would have died if we followed their directions?" I asked. Frankie nodded. I wanted to go back to where I had seen them and use the last of my magazine on those sick weirdos, but I tried to focus on my breathing and calm down.
"Jeez, old man, it's a good thing we found you,"
Gil said, reaching into his pocket with his unmutilated hand. "You want another chocolate bar?" From what we had learned from Frankie, who tended to stare off into space and drift off topic but seemed otherwise all there, the people who sacrificed each other to the Iron Maiden, or, as they called it, the Steel Mistress, were all refugees from Rusty Township. They were also apparently cannibal cult members. Once they had drained the blood from whoever picked the burnt match, or played tic-tac-toe the worst, or whatever other insane way they chose, they would throw the mutilated body into the opening of the undergraves. The demons would come out after the drums and drag the body away to eat it. And the cult members also tended to send wayward travelers, like ourselves, down into the undergraves to get killed and eaten by demons. Apparently, they thought these precautions kept them safe from the majority of the horrors of the undergraves. And hell, they had survived this long, so maybe they were right. The urge to go back and murder the whole lot of them came strongly to me. I could see Gil felt the same way. But getting home was far more important.
Frankie had lived here for years, foraging from the occasional vending machines and stealing supplies from the cult members and demons. I assumed this means he ate a lot of human meat for a lot of his calories. But I wasn't going to point it out. It just didn't seem polite at this point. He seemed like a hard guy to upset, though. After all the things he had seen, it was hard to imagine him turning out otherwise. But it also meant he knew the halls and intersections like the back of his hand. When I explained to him the staircase that we had came through, his eyes lit up.
"I know it," he said, "but it's nowhere near the Undergraves. It changes, but it's always found at either the beginning of the Endless Hall."
"That's where we came in, I think," Gil said. "It seems endless enough."
"Or it hides between the meeting place of Veridin and Rusty Township."
"So we were right next to it?" I asked angrily. Now I really wanted to kill those lunatic cult members. Frankie nodded, drawing back slightly, his eyes widening at my anger.
"Well, let's go," Gil said, looking more tired than I had ever seen him, holding the bloody bandaged remains of his hand against his chest and wincing.
"I'm tired as hell, but I'd like to get out of here before those nutjobs find us and throw us into the Iron Maiden, or maybe some pig monster slices me up and makes jerky from my muscles."
Frankie shot his head violently.
"No, no, no," Frankie said. "If you go back the way you come, you will die. The drums stopped."
"What are the drums?" I asked. He shrugged.
"They come from the ceilings and walls," he said, describing a small black box that sounded like a speaker. "Maybe they were originally set up before the collapse of the Rusty Township. I don't know, friend."
"I don't give a flying F about the drums," Gil said. "What happens if we just walk back the way we came?"
"The cleaner comes after the drums," Frankie said in a whisper. "The cleaner is mean. He is a tall metal man, as tall as the ceilings, and he is strong. I've seen him snap the pigmen in half."
"So, is there another way around the main hall?" I asked. Frankie took a long moment to think, then he nodded.
"It's dangerous, too," he said. "The tunnel underneath leads back, but it has strange things."
This was all he would say about it. "Okay, Frankie, lead the way," Gil said, throwing the deformed man a bag of jerky and a soda. We were getting very low on food and drinks by this point, but as I saw it, it wouldn't matter. Either we would get out and we would have plenty of food and drinks back home, or we wouldn't, and we wouldn't need food or drinks if that was the case. An old riddle popped into my head as I considered this. What is greater than God, worse than the devil? The dead eat it always, but if the living eat it, then they die. Nothing. Frankie got up quickly, eating the entire bag of beef jerky in a single swallow. How I didn't even know that was possible until I saw him do it. His cheeks were stuffed like a chipmunk, and he chewed slowly and thoroughly with his few remaining teeth, savoring the taste of the meat. Then he went back behind a pile of clothing, felt around on the floor, and with the cry of triumph, pulled out a weapon. It was just a baseball bat with rusty, bent nails sticking out of it like broken quills of a porcupine, but it was better than nothing.
"Let's go, friends," Frankie said. "I would do anything to help my new friends. You should go home where you belong. We all need a home."
He trailed off sadly. I looked around at where he lived, and my heart broke for him. He stuck his huge head out the door, looking up and down the main hallway of the Undergraves. Slick, muscular growths covered the walls, the ceiling, and the floors. The red stuff seemed to contrast and expand, as if it were undergoing peristosis. With a look back, he nodded and went forward. We followed along, placing all of our trust in this strange being who called us his friends. The hatchway to the tunnel was in an auxiliary room a few hundred feet down the hall. I walked in front next to Frankie, seeing as I had a gun and needed to be able to shoot in an instant without worrying about them being in my way.
The hatchway was rusted and ancient-looking. It had a wheel that had to be turned to open it, and it took the strength of all three of us to get it moving. It squealed loudly, flakes of rust splintering off it. I cursed under my breath, hoping that it wouldn't draw attention. As soon as it was open, we went down the ladder, one by one, underneath the main hall. The tunnel was cramped and dark. Red emergency lights placed every few hundred feet or so gave us some illumination, but not much. Everything had a bloody glow to it, and there were auxiliary shafts running off the main one, some with no lights at all. But in the darkness, I could have sworn I saw movement, as if slightly less black silhouettes were moving towards us through the darkness. We got through as fast as we could, another ladder leading up, and we took it. But that strange sensation of being followed by dark shapes didn't leave me. The ladder opened into a room I didn't recognize at first. The hatchway panel opened up into a place filled with detritus. Broken furniture and mold spread throughout all over the floor. But when we got into the main hallway, I felt like cheering. Further down, I saw the sign for the intersection of Rusty Township and Veridon. And crossing in front of it, I saw the cult members who had tried to give us directions to the Ninth Circle of Hell, or whatever that place truly was. "Stop right frickin' there!" I screamed, raising the gun. The dark-haired woman with the scurvy blossoms on her face jumped so high, I thought she might fall over. The other cult members turned and looked at me, surprised and afraid. "Didn't expect to see me again, did you? Thought that I would get killed by demons? And maybe you could take my body and eat it? Or just have it as a sacrifice to those abominations?"
"Sir, I am sorry," the woman said, "but we must get out of here. The machine."
"Stay right there, I will blow your frickin' head off," I said, walking forward quickly and shoving the gun in her face. "Your brains will be dripping off the wall. You're not going anywhere." And then I heard it. A mechanical whine started down the hallway, coming closer.
"The cleaner,"
Frankie whispered in a tone that reminded me of a scared voice of a child.
"Oh God, the cleaner."
I kept the gun raised, but prodded the woman forwards towards the intersection of the three hallways, looking down towards the Rusty Township side, where the noises were coming from. What I saw sent my heart racing. It was a robot, at least 10 feet tall. Its silvery skin shone in the flickering fluorescent lights. It had two eyes that shone white LED lights, a slit for a mouth, long arms and legs that looked like they had been made of steel beams.
"Freeze,"
it said in an emotionless voice. "Please show identification." The cult members screamed and started to scatter like cockroaches. The robot instantly responded upon seeing them move, taking one of its long arms and running forward, whipping it across the hall in a blur. I heard bones crack and saw bodies break as they were pushed into the walls and, in one case, out the window. I heard shrieking for a few seconds as the hopeless man fell to his death.
"You've killed us all,"
the dark-haired woman told me accusingly. She tried to run away from me as I backpedaled away from the insane robot, but it grabbed her, twisting off her neck with a loud crack. Blood poured out of her head as the robot threw it across the ground, rolling it like a bowling ball. "You are in violation of execution order number 82, the robot said. "Show identification or lethal force will be used." It was running at me now, and I saw it approaching as if in slow motion. I knew I was dead. And then Frankie came running out, swinging his baseball bat as hard as he could into the robot's back. The nails stuck into the metal. I saw his large muscles bulging as he tried to pull it out. But before he could, the robot turned and hit him with a balled-up metal hand. Frankie's skull collapsed inwards as he fell, crumpling into a heap in the corner.
"No!"
I screamed, running forwards. I looked at the bright eyes of the robot, and suddenly, an idea came to me. It was the only one I had. I started emptying the magazine into the robot's face, and within seconds, its wide eyes had bursted. My ears were ringing from so many gunshots in such a small space. Sparks and wires shot out, and the robot began to wail. The smell of gunpowder and burning metal filled the area. "Visual centers offline," it said. "Visual centers offline. This is a catastrophic error. Contact Victoria at Arms Corporation and report the location and type of this error. A large reward is offered. Please call 1-600-333. I stopped listening. The robot had begun to move randomly, swinging its arms and legs in wide circles as its alarm blared. I saw it crush a few more cult members to death. It smashed into the walls, breaking the sheetrock and leaving huge dents and holes everywhere. I ran over to Frankie. He was still alive, though he was fading rapidly. His eyes were shutting.
"Did I help my friends?"
he said slowly, sadly. I nodded, a single tear falling from my eye. "You saved us," I said. "I'm so sorry." He nodded, then closed his eyes and let out a long breath.
"The stairs are down the Veridan Hall, before the train to Naraka," he said. "Go home, friend. Go home."
Blood pooled around his broken head as his lips began to turn blue and his breath stopped. Gil pulled me up, whispering in my ear.
"I think we're being followed," he said. "We need to go now."
And so we did. We began running down the hallway. I looked back, seeing the bodies of the dead cult members and the kamikaze writhing of the robot as he smashed into random rooms and went further down the hallway towards Rusty Township. But there was something there, something dark and humanoid. I squinted, but it faded into the shadows.
"There!"
Gil yelled, pointing to a door I recognized. It was a chipped blue door with a daisy painted on the front. My euphoria and elation was so high at seeing it that I grabbed Gil and hugged him.
"Frankie did it," I said. "He got us here."
And then we heard the shriek from behind us. I turned to look, but it was all dark shadows now behind us. The flickering lights had died. We flung open the door, running through it. It opened up to the same circular stone steps that we had used to get down here. They were still slick, still endless, and still had no railing. But my adrenaline was so high that I just started sprinting. My fear of heights had nothing on my fears of what was down here with us. But whatever it was following us, it was getting closer. I could hear it gaining, hearing it shrieking. I checked my gun as I ran, and I was not surprised to see that I had no ammo left. All we had was that damn Bowie knife. I was exhausted, but we kept going, on the verge of passing out. Eventually, the temperature started to go up, and the air felt less oppressive and thick. I could see the entrance to the shed a few more revelations up around the circular stones. Using the last of our energy, we sprinted to the end of the stairs. We ran out into the shed, clearing the last of the slick stone steps. The door was locked, just like when we had left it. There seemed to be new gouges in the plate metal shielding the interior of the shed, deep claw marks and linings running every which way, but especially over the shielding for the door.
"Hurry up," I said through gritted teeth. "It's coming."
"I can't," Gil said, reaching into every pocket. He kept coming up empty-handed. He had lost the key, and now we were going to die. I slammed a new magazine into the pistol, ready to fight to the death. Then he reached into the little pocket built into the main pocket of his right front jeans, and I heard a tiny jingle. He brought up the leather strap with the shed key on it. With shaking hands, he shoved it in the lock and began turning. I heard deep thudding footsteps only feet behind us now, and a demonic voice began to shriek. My ears rang in its high-pitched squealing, but I kept my hand on the now useless gun, looking back and forth from the door to the last step, just as Gil pushed open the door. I saw it. It had empty black sockets where its eyes should have been. Its skin looked like the tight, desiccated skin of a mummy, and it seemed to tremble and writhe as its body moved. Its mouth opened nearly to the center of its chest, just a huge black void that sent out deafening screams consistently, seemingly without needing to breathe. We slammed the door shut. I put all my body weight against it as Gil put the key back on the lock and began the turn. There was a tremendous shake as the abomination slammed into the door, and then Gil clicked the lock into place and pulled the key out. I slid to the floor, my heart beating so fast I couldn't feel the individual beats anymore. After resting a while, we went back into the house. Gil flipped on the TV, where we saw breaking news flashing across the screen on our local channel. The death of the entire family in Lancaster County today continues to remain unsolved. Authorities state the neighbor found the bodies of Larry Matheson, age 46, his wife Linda Matheson, age 41, and their children, Jonathan Matheson, age 11, Jordan Matheson, age 7, and Abigail Matheson, age 3. Authorities state that the amount of violence at the scene was unbelievable, and that the victims were physically mutilated both before and after death. In addition, authorities told our reporters that the heads of the children were removed, and that they still found no sign of them. Police believe the killer or killers likely took the heads with them. Anyone with any leads is asked to call. I shut the TV off. Gil looked up at me. The shrieking in the shed started up again, and I heard scratching and clawing coming from behind the house.
Something got out, I said. Something got out of the shed.